I'm delighted this morning that we have Rabbi Harari with us. She took up the position of a rabbi at Temple Beth Ora, the Reformed shul in Edmonton, in 2008. Rabbi Harari was born in Israel, in Haifa, the great city of Haifa, right on the sea, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, one of the great ports
in Israel. And grew up in small Reformed congregations in Israel and in the United States. And as a young rabbi, or as a youth,
yeah.
She was involved in a number of Reformed organizations for young people, and also in Wisconsin. How do you pronounce the name of that great city in Wisconsin?
Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc. And she also served as a counselor and resident director there, and was involved in the North American Federation of Temple Youth, serving as religious and cultural vice president for the region. She was ordained at the Hebrew Union College, the Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati, mm-hmm. in 2008, and served student congregations in West Virginia. So you can all break into song. There are wonderful songs about West Virginia, Indiana, and Tennessee. Her rabbinical thesis was an analysis of the genesis of the Reform Movement's new prayer book, which was being published at the time. So she was on top of a current significant matter. On the way down here, we talked a little bit about something that has interested me, which is the way in which the Reform Movement has, over the last 20, 30 years, been involved in a kind of renaissance of Jewish tradition. And it was interesting to hear her reflections on how that came about. So Rabbi Harari is also a member of the board of directors of the Edmonton Interfaith Center for Education and Action, and is also involved in the Central Conference of American Rabbis to the Union for Reform Judaism, the Joint Commission on Worship. So it's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And we look forward to listening to you and engaging you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'll begin, first of all, by saying thank you so much for the invitation. And I'm very excited to be here. I'm also marveling at the number of people who are up at this hour of the morning. Because, in fact, this is normally not my hour. I'm more of a night owl, but it's really, truly a pleasure. My first visit in Camrose. So thank you for such a warm welcome. And so you'll keep an eye on time for me, yes?
I will.
Fantastic. My bio I'm sort of amused by, because it's full of run-on sentences. I might have the longest descriptions of anybody on anything. But I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about my family, because I think it leads a little bit into my own story and my own journey into the rabbinate. My father was born in 1945 in Israel, then Palestine, under the British Mandate, in Haifa. And his parents both came from Czechoslovakia. My grandfather I never met, but I've heard all kinds of stories about. My grandmother, whom I had the pleasure of knowing for the first 25 years of my life, I know a bit more of her story, and she was a Zionist who essentially spent her youth looking toward building up the State of Israel. And in 1938, having grown up in this Orthodox family, she was the sixth of seven children, basically said to her parents, "I'm moving. I'm going. I want to build up this Jewish state." And her parents said, "No, you have to wait for the Messiah." She said, "Nope, see you." And as a result, was one of two people in our family that survived through the Holocaust, the other being her niece, my father's first cousin, who is a survivor of Auschwitz. And in 19... I don't even know what year, Shortly after the end of the war, she was a bit older. She's, I don't know how old she actually is, but in probably circa 1949-ish, maybe, 48, 47. It might have been before, actually. I don't even know what year it would have been. Somewhere around the end of the war, she basically was rescued from Auschwitz by a Christian family that brought her to a convent where, for whatever reason, they chose to tell her she was Jewish. She grew up there for a few years, and about 3 years later, was my grandmother's family was found in Israel, and she was brought there because that was the only living family that they had, and she grew up with my father like a sister. So a pretty amazing story in that sense. But my father grew up in a family that I'm going to call sort of traditional, in the sense that when they went to synagogue, they went to the Orthodox synagogue, or rather my father went with his father and his younger brother. My grandmother probably did not attend much. They kept a kosher home. They did a few things. But when my dad was 16, under the influence of a rabbi at the school that he attended, named for Leo Beck, who whom many of you may be familiar with. He was a scholar who was a Reform rabbi rescued by actually the seminary I attended in the 1930s, just before the Holocaust, and brought to the States. My dad met a rabbi there who sent him on a 6-month study abroad to Boston. So he went to high school at Newton South High School in the Boston area, and for the first time in his life was introduced to the Reform movement, came back to Israel, and I guess I could call him sort of a pioneer in the Israeli Reform movement, in that he was amongst the first to be ordained through the Hebrew Union College, which is the institution I was ordained through as well, the Reform Seminary in Jerusalem. He was ordained when I was 4 years old. My mother grew up in the Chicago area, and she grew up in the Reform movement. It was something that was in her family for many years. My great aunt, who recently turned 90, to give you an idea of her age, was one of the first directors of what was called the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods, now the Women of Reform Judaism. So she spent a lot of time in that organization. And the Reform movement, the camp that David mentioned that I grew up at, has been around since 1951. And it's something that my great aunt was a part of and something my mother was a part of. My mother grew up at that camp and beyond being a camper, actually served as a staff member and did a lot of other things there as well. She was the assistant director of the camp. So the camping movement in the 1960s and 70s is where my mother sort of really built up her Jewish identity. And she also, at 16, participated in the same program my father participated in, but in the reverse. And she was sent to Israel just following the Six-Day War in 1967. I think much to my grandmother's chagrin, who worried very much about her safety, and fell in love with it. So that in 1974, I want to say, she made Aliyah, she moved to Israel. She had met my father, who had served as a counselor. They were not yet involved at the time. And when she moved to Israel, they reconnected, and they started to date and got married. I was born in 1977 in Haifa, same city where my father was born and grew up. And we basically lived sort of an existence that was an unusual existence in that I was involved in the Reform movement from the time I was born. This Israeli Reform movement, which was fledgling at the time. When I was 4, my father was ordained through the college in Jerusalem. And I was part of this very small community of up-and-coming and recently ordained Reform rabbis in Israel, many of whom still remain very close friends. We just had our biennial convention in Washington, D.C. I just saw the son of one of those rabbis, the guy that my dad used to be roommates with, and he is now a rabbi, and his sister just got accepted into the seminary as well. So definitely something that I think speaks to a trend. And that is sort of what I would say if you ask me about my becoming a rabbi. I would say to you that my journey is much of me following in my father's footsteps, going into the family business. And the reason I say this in particular is because I do have the unique distinction of being one, if not the only, a member of one of the only families, if not the only family, in North America, wherein, as of 2008, I am an only child. My mother, my father, and I are all Reform rabbis. So my mother became ordained also around the same time that I did. I began school in 2003 in Jerusalem, and she joined a year later, having tested out of that first year. I could have tested out, chose to go and spend a year living and seeing Israel through North American eyes, and it was amazing. My own journey has been a little bit unique. And I'm going to sort of say something that perhaps may sound a bit provocative, but I like to say that I think my own journey, unlike many others, has not been the result of what many clergy people, I think, experience as a calling, but rather something that I just came into naturally. From the time that I was about 13 years old, my father had me helping out in his synagogue. When I was training for my bat mitzvah, he taught me how to read from the Torah. And as such, he decided, he made a rule, at least once a month I had to come in and read from the Torah to keep up that skill. And as long as I was coming in, he would come down from the bima, from our pulpit, in the middle of the service, and he would sit down next to me, and he would say, okay, you're going to go and chant from the Haftarah, you're going to chant from the prophets, and I learned to do that very quickly by sight reading, and he started giving me more and more opportunity to be involved. As you heard, I was very involved in my youth movement. I was very much a product of my movement. Between camps, between all of these different experiences, I was a very proud Reformed Jew for many years. My journey changed a little bit when I began university. I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities in Minneapolis. And during my first year of university, I took an Introduction to Judaism course. Has anybody ever taken such a course? So here I am, all of 18 years old, daughter of a Reform rabbi. I grew up doing all these things, and I walked in with an attitude that, of course, many of us have when we are young. What are you going to teach me? I mean, come on. I know everything, right? I speak Hebrew fluently. What do I need to know? And, of course, my life changed drastically when Rabbi Gordon, who was teaching the class, assigned us all to do a Jewish experience. And that Jewish experience could be pretty much anything, but we had to experience something and write about it. Most of my classmates were going across the street to the Hillel, which is a Jewish student organization. I was on my way to becoming student president of that organization, so that certainly wouldn't do for my experience. So he said to me, have you ever been to an Orthodox synagogue? I said, no. He said, good, you're going. Closed his book and walked out of the room before I could even respond. So I was left with this sort of experience that needed to happen. And over the course of the quarter at the time, we were on a quarter system, I hemmed and I hawed and I'm thinking to myself, all right, I need to get over there. I need to get over there. I need to go experience this and write about it, because soon enough the assignment would be due. And about a week before it was due, I realized, in fact, I hadn't yet completed the assignment. Very fortunately for me, I was teaching at a religious school. I was working as a tutor, a Hebrew tutor, in a religious school for one of the Reform congregations, where, ironically, many of the staff members were Orthodox Jews. It was a really unique sort of microcosm. I didn't know it at the time. But one of the people that was working with me in the tutoring room was a woman who had grown up in the Reform movement and at my age chosen to become Orthodox. And she very simply looked at me and said, oh, you need to go to a synagogue? You can come to my house for Shabbat. You can come spend the Sabbath at my house. I said, are you sure? She said, of course. So I very cautiously and trepidatiously put myself together and borrowed some clothing because I didn't have appropriate modest clothing at the time. This was not the style. Skirts down to here and long sleeves were not something I owned much of. And I went to her house. And what started as an assignment for a class ended up being a three-year affair with a movement where I spent a lot of time thinking that I had essentially been taught wrong. My eyes were suddenly opened. I looked to my parents and said, how come you told me that I grew up keeping kosher when in fact really what we did wasn't so strict?
You just held butter on your BLT.
I actually grew up definitely separating meat and milk. I grew up in an Israel that was very Jewish, where you couldn't get non-kosher meat at the time. And if you could, I certainly didn't know about it. But it was a very different experience. And I fell in love with one thing that I will argue that the Reform movement is learning how to do better, but that the Orthodoxy certainly does in a way that no other movement for me experientially does, and that is community. Plain and simple, walking into someone's home, knowing that after a service, it didn't matter that I didn't know a single soul in that community, I would have had a place to go and have lunch. I would have been welcomed into any number of homes. And it was something that I very much connected to. Again, being younger, I was learning a lot about ideology and theology. And 3 years later, when I was getting ready to graduate from the university, and I started to think about these things, things came full circle for me as I sort of struggled with a lot of ideas of what was my role as a woman in this community. And that was something that still sort of sat and kind of in the back of my mind was troubling me, was that at first I really enjoyed the fact that I could just sit in a women's gallery and not have to do anything in that service. No one was getting off the pulpit to come and say to me, you're next, you're going up. But after a while, I looked and I said, you know, this isn't working for me. And I found that my own views, both politically, both culturally, didn't seem to mesh with some of those ideals. And one of the most difficult experiences I had was surrounding the last months I was in that community when a death occurred of a baby. A baby had died of SIDS in that community very tragically. And the same friend who had welcomed me into her home, she and her husband had become like my surrogate family, said, you know, this is a sign from God. This is a sign from God to this community. We're not treating each other well enough. God had to send us this sign. And I couldn't believe that she, who was a nurse by training, was coming up with a theological argument like that. I struggled very much with the idea of reward and punishment as a doctrine. And that, for me, was sort of a turning point because I said, I'm not sure that this works for me anymore. So while I really loved the level of observance, I loved the communal experience. And there's nothing like, for me, nothing like spending a Shabbat like that. Spending an entire day where I abstained from anything electronic, where it really was, I loved the idea that we live by God's time and not by our own time. Something so unique and so fantastic because as a Reformed Jew, I'd spent much of my time much more in the modern world. And not really observing in that way. But ideologically and theologically, it wasn't working. And that set me a little bit on a journey. So I did a lot of exploring, and I spent time in a conservative community for a while, thinking, well, maybe this will be the right thing. But ultimately, I found myself, 4 years after my graduation from the university, I found myself having worked for two pluralistic Jewish organizations, one being Hillel, the Jewish campus community at university, and the second being a place called the American Hebrew Academy, which is the first unaffiliated, liberal, egalitarian, put every other, you know, adjective on it, boarding high school in North America. It's located in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's now in its 12th year. It's an amazing space, or 11th year. And I was there in its very first year, and 2 years actually. An amazing experience, because being in a community that valued all of those differences allowed me to start really thinking for myself, to start really putting together where I stood on issues. And suddenly, when there wasn't necessarily the pressure to be something, but rather the ability for me to interact with people of different levels of observance and the ability for me to be able to connect. Greensboro is unique in that there isn't an Orthodox community there. There was a conservative community that I began in and a Reform community where I found myself ending up. And it allowed me to come back to the Reform movement from a perspective that had now been exposed to much more and to look at it through what I'm going to call adult eyes. I love the idea that Jewishly, we never stop learning. So I say on one level that I am very much consciously a Reformed Jew today. It was a choice I came to. But at the same time, I also like the idea that I'm always going to keep learning and that I don't want to be the same person 5 years from now that I am today. I joke. Maybe it's not so much of a joke anymore, but it's a little lame, so forgive me, but that I knew I was an adult for two reasons. One, when I started drinking coffee even when there wasn't cream available. And the other was, as you've heard now, I'm not a Canadian, so when I started listening to National Public Radio by choice. So those were sort of my two jokes about how I knew I was an adult. But I knew that I was an adult Jewishly when I stopped kind of fighting back against what I'd been taught or hadn't been taught about what I had experienced and hadn't experienced, and when I started engaging with text for real. When I started studying Torah and not just saying, oh, it's not so relevant to me anymore, when I made it relevant for myself. And those are the elements that sort of brought me back to the Reformed community. That, and of course, as I said, ideological and theological arguments, most of which relate to the idea that, for me, egalitarianism is always going to be an important element. Women's roles being equal to those of men, equal opportunities. For me, it also became very apparent that my theological understandings are very limited on some level. And in that sense, I don't mean that that I don't necessarily understand, but rather that I don't connect to a very literal meaning of text, and I don't connect to doctrines wherein God is necessarily central. And this is where perhaps the more provocative element comes in. I like to say that I became a rabbi to work with people, not to work with God. God is a part of my life. God is a part of the lives of many members of my community. But my work and my primary role, as I understand it, as a rabbi, is to build community. And that, for me, becomes sort of my mission. The word rabbi means teacher. You asked me in the car about what I love to do. I love to teach. I love to engage with people, and I love to experience with other people their own development. As adults, I look to my community, and I always say one of my ulterior motives is for every individual to have their own personal theology and their own personal understanding of where they stand. It doesn't have to be the same tomorrow as it is today, but have a sense of who you are religiously. Have a sense of why you believe what you believe or why you don't believe what you don't believe. And that, for me, was a central message this year, and I spoke about it at Yom Kippur on the Day of Atonement in my congregation, the idea of us being consciously who we are and having a sense of who we are religiously, because ultimately I think it means for us a richer and more powerful experience. So I think I'm sort of going to end with that, and I know this is sort of all over the map, but I want to give an opportunity for sort of questions, answers, and thank you for listening.
Great. So, if I can ask the first question.
Sure.
So I love this line that you became a rabbi to work with community and not with God.
Yes.
So you don't have to, you don't feel responsible to teach God anything.
What do you mean by that?
I always thought Judaism was engaged in teaching God all the time.
Okay. So I'm gonna say the following. One of the things that I think makes the Reform movement unique, unlike many of the other movements, Judaism does have some dogma in it, and it is primarily the idea that in the Reform, in the Orthodox understanding, in the more traditional understanding, absolutely, one God. There is no question in my mind that if you were a part of a more traditional community, you would have a sense of what that means, and that God would perhaps be more at the center in a different way. Reform Judaism, unlike any other movement, does not have one single theology or one single ideology that defines the movement. As such, I feel much freer, in a sense, to engage with God, but to engage with God in a different way. I do feel responsible to teach God, absolutely. I think it's important that people learn about different Jewish conceptions and perceptions of God. I taught an adult education class a couple of years ago where we went through and I think we looked at probably about 12 different thinkers from the medieval times until modern times. And there are lots of elements. My own theology, I think, you know, one of the biggest aha moments I had in my in rabbinical school was when the day that I realized that I'm not just like Isaac Mayer Wise, who was one of the major founders of the movement in North America, but I've also got a little bit of David Einhorn, who was amongst another one of the founders of the movement, the guy who wrote the first sort of North American Reform prayer book. And they came from very opposite ends of the spectrum. So in that sense, I engage with God, absolutely. But I also think that my primary task has to do with how I interact with people and bring people together.
Great.
So
please.
Pat.
I missed the first little bit, so excuse me if you spoke to this or maybe ask the philosophy. So, I'm really interested in, given your journey within the different faith traditions and stuff,
So I'll start with the first question, which deals with the question of, I think, very sadly, in my perception, a bit of sort of a coercion and a monopoly that is happening within the ultra-Orthodox. And I'm going to specify ultra-Orthodox because I think it's not fair to say Orthodox. It's really the ultra-Orthodox, particularly in Jerusalem, though, and some of the areas surrounding Jerusalem in Israel right now. One of the great sort of paradoxes, if you will, of the state of Israel is that it's founded as a Jewish state. But what that means is very different for someone like me versus for someone who comes from a more Orthodox tradition. And one of the difficulties is that Israel, in some ironic sort of twist, started off as this place where all these secular people were going, people who didn't want the religious element, people like my grandmother who said, I'm not waiting for the Messiah, because I believe that I should be there building the land. And somebody once said to me, you know, Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of the state of Israel, sort of without meaning to, created this reality where, you know, these rabbis have power because he made a deal with them. I don't know exactly how it all happened. What I do know is that right now the state of Israel is in rather a dire place because there isn't room for pluralism, at least not yet. We've seen some developments in the last few years that have been very heartening, one of which is that for the first time since God only knows when, there has been some recognition of the work of non-Orthodox rabbis outside the state of Israel, so that someone who undergoes a conversion, let's say, to Judaism, with someone like me, would actually be recognized to a degree. If I perform a marriage,
and that's new.
This is a relatively new development.
In the last few years.
In the last few years. And it changes every day is the other problem. It's very schizophrenic over there. So some days, you know, some days I'm valid, some days not so much. you know, you're seeing a little bit of the fact that there is a little bit of recognition of what's going on outside the state with non-Orthodox rabbis. Inside the state, there is a wonderful organization called the Israel Religious Action Center. It is the mirror slash sister slash twin, whatever you want to call it, organization to an organization in Washington, D.C. called the Religious Action Center. And the Religious Action Center has been the lobbying arm of the Reform movement for the last 50 years. And the work that they have done in the states has been tremendous. They've been on the forefront of the fight for civil rights, for women's rights, for you name it, across the board. They do outstanding work, not the least of which, of course, fights for these rights and from the Jewish perspective in the states. In Israel, the Israel Religious Action Center, they're known as IRAC, and they do outstanding work. So, for example, there's a group called the Women of the Wall. Have any of you ever heard of this group? They are a group of women that once a month meets in order to have a women's minyan, a women's service at the Western Wall. They're a group of women that come from across the board. So you've got Orthodox to Reform to sort of not quite secular, because secular Jews aren't necessarily praying, but you're getting everybody from across the spectrum. And they like to have a service once a month on the new moon, which is traditionally considered a special women's holiday in the Jewish tradition. And they have been the subject of just horrible, horrible harassment. Many women from the group have been arrested for daring to carry a Torah scroll, something that is traditionally considered the property, if you will, excuse the term, of men. Something that women should not be doing. They should not be reading aloud from the Torah scroll because they've raised their voices. Women's voices are considered to be alluring in the Jewish tradition, according to the Orthodoxy, according to Jewish law. Men should not be listening to women's voices since they are considered to be on a lower spiritual plane than women and may not be able to control their urges. This is the reality. So they are taught that they shouldn't listen to women's voices singing. These women, never mind, are doing everything in accordance with Jewish law, because there's absolutely no problem when there are no men present for a woman to sing. But they've been subject to a lot of harassment. Women have been arrested. There are women who choose to wear traditional garb, such as a kippah, a yarmulke, or a tallit, a prayer shawl, both of which are considered to be men's garb, and have literally been subject to physical beatings and violence by men in the ultra-Orthodox community. The Israel Religious Action Center has taken, I'll come to you in one second, the Israel Religious Action Center has taken a lot of steps toward fighting for the rights of these women, and that's been a really fantastic turn. Same as there are buses now in Jerusalem that have been deemed segregated routes, where women are supposed to sit in the back of the bus and men in the front. And many of the women associated with this organization have gone on campaigns where a bunch of women will get on buses, pay their fare, and sit right up front where they're not supposed to and refuse to move. They have also been fighting on behalf of Israeli rabbis in the conservative and reform movements to be able to get equal funding. The state pays the salary of how many Orthodox rabbis, and they don't pay a single cent, or a single shekel, I should say, agora. They don't pay a single agora, which is the equivalent of a cent in its own way, to the Reform and Orthodox the Reform and Conservative movements. So that's something that they've been working on, and they actually were able to get some funding for Reform and Conservative conversion programs in Israel in the last couple of years. So there is a little bit of hope on the horizon, but it's something that, if you ask about the role of North American Jews absolutely need to support these organizations, whether it be the Conservative and Reform congregations, whether it be Conservative and Reform seminaries and their programs in Israel, and promote pluralism. Because ultimately, if we don't speak up, right now the biggest place that's under sort of scrutiny is the army. The army, which has been secular for so many years, where there have been constant arguments about the ultra-Orthodox Jews who don't serve, but rather are, and this is where everybody traditionally would serve. And now they're arguing against women singing in the induction ceremonies, where for years and years this is something that has happened. So there has been a lot to be said for that role. I think it's the place of North American Jews, if we care about having an Israel that is, as it was founded, a democratic state and a pluralistic state. So when it says that it's the homeland of every Jew, it means it's the homeland for every Jew, no matter what your level of observance, no matter who you are. I think that our role needs to be absolutely to speak up and to support organizations that are doing work there on behalf of those.
Pat, do you want to pick up on some of that or push it?
Really appreciate the thoroughness around that, and just, I guess, just related to what you just said, finally. And so in terms of democracy and a democratic Israel, mm-hmm. how do you see the you know where I'm going, the Palestinian presence to be and to want to be, and so on?
you've spoken about the pluralism within the Jewish within the Jewish family. What about the
pluralism vis-a-vis others? I think it's important to note that the state of Israel has always been a democratic state since its inception, so 65 years, right? We are talking about a state wherein any Arabs that are living within the bounds of the state of Israel are full citizens of the state. We have Arab members of the Knesset who represent parties and some of those interests. And I think, first and foremost, it's an important thing to note because I think it sometimes gets lost in that question. So anybody who, there are many Arab Israelis who live within the state and have full rights under those laws. So that's the first thing. The question of what's going to happen is a really good question. I grew up in a house that was quite liberal, and since the time that I was a kid, I think my father, who is the Israeli in the relationship amongst my parents, will tell you that he's even shifted a bit to the right. Experience has been a very sad story for us. From the Israeli perspective, I think the experience has been such that there have been many attempts at peace, and that extremists on both sides have made those attempts go awry and make it impossible for us to reach sort of that place where everyone's in agreement. My personal experience, I think I would argue, is a bit biased in the sense that as an Israeli, I think I tend to be a bit more to the right in that sense. My experience says that, unfortunately, especially during the time of Rabin, prior to his assassination, we came so close, and yet there doesn't seem to be a full partner on the other side. Having said that, I hope, ultimately, that we will be able to reach some sort of solution. My feeling would be at this point that probably a two-state solution is the best solution for everybody involved. There have to be compromises on both sides. I don't think either side is free of guilt. I think both sides have made some egregious errors. I do know that I grew up when I was 5 years old, we were living in Nahariya. So if you know where Haifa is on the map, go an hour north, right on the Lebanon border, about 10 minutes away from the Lebanon border. And if any of you know what was happening in Israel in 1982, it was the first Lebanon War. I spent a year of my life going back and forth, bomb shelters, apartment bomb shelter, apartment bomb shelter. And, you know, so I've lived through the first. We moved away from Israel before the first Intifada started taking place. But I have experienced some of that terror, and I know how scary that is. I know enough to say that while there are extremists, Israelis, one thing I haven't seen happen is much by way of that kind of terror. Nonetheless, I also very strongly, for example, would say to you that I think one of the barriers to peace, for example, are the ultra-Orthodox who insist on creating settlements in a land which is completely non-connected to us religiously. And I frankly supported the government a few years ago when they came and bulldozed some of those settlements, because I think that's where a lot of the extremism is happening. I would like to see us get to a place where there can be communication, where there can be some sort of solution reached. But I ultimately don't, very sadly at this point, I don't see it happening in my lifetime. I don't know what's going to be. So.
Yeah.
I know that there was a hand here, and I apologize. I know it's been a little while here. So,
it's out of ignorance, but I ask, you referred to the women's gatherings once mm-hmm. a month and the harassment that the extremists
yes.
passed and even from that.
Mm-hmm.
So who would do the arresting, and by what authority? Would that be by a state or by...
Yes. Basically, the Western Wall right now is in the old city of Jerusalem. And Jerusalem in particular has a very, very high concentration of ultra-Orthodox Jews. There are certain neighborhoods where quite literally, you know, you go through there on the Sabbath. A classmate of mine, when we were living in Jerusalem, happened to be riding his bicycle one Saturday afternoon and by accident turned into this neighborhood. There were rocks thrown at him. There were other things thrown at him because God forbid that he should desecrate the Sabbath by riding a bicycle. the authority, unfortunately, you know, the police are the people who are doing the arresting, but it's sort of by the authority of the ultra-Orthodox rabbinate, the chief rabbinate of Israel. Another incident, which is just as disturbing, happened, for example, I want to say it was in Beersheba, which is in the south. A woman had been to a morning service at a conservative synagogue wherein she did what's called laying tefillin, which are phylacteries. Are people familiar with that? Oh, yay! That's exciting. Most people have never even heard
these
that
These are all
word.
Ultra-Orthodox Jews here.
Clearly. So as you know, these are leather straps which get wrapped around the arm. She had marks on her arm, stripes that were left, because they're wrapped tightly enough that she could feel them. And she was beaten by Orthodox Jews in the bus station while she was waiting for the bus later, because they could see marks on her arm. The authority itself... Oh, yeah. Those are regular citizens. The arrests that are happening as the result of, you know, the authority is essentially coming from the chief rabbinate, which is in control. If you look today at the breakdown of the Knesset, the parliament of Israel, it is far more ultra-Orthodox than it is on the other side. And so as a result, you're seeing a lot more people controlling, you know, Jewish law is guiding the civil law much more. So, you know, basically, the Western Wall, if any of you has anybody ever been to the Western Wall? We've got a couple of people who've been. You've seen it. There is no room for freedom of expression there. Jewish law is going to hold firm.
So right? These women go to the wall to pray.
Correct. And there is an
and
area...
And now is there a policy that says they can't do that?
There is an unwritten rule, as it were. The wall has a separation. The men's section is probably three-quarters the size of the space, and the women's section is about a quarter. If you go in immodest dressed, you know, if you're wearing a short enough skirt or pants even, pants may not be so much of a problem, but anything that's short would be problematic. Anything that doesn't have sleeves, not a high enough collarbone, you're in trouble.
And carrying a separate Torah,
women
putting on talit or something
wearing,
would be a problem.
Exactly. Because the men who are there are going to go into upheaval.
It'd actually be against the law?
It is considered against the law there.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's actually against the law of the State of Israel, I couldn't tell you. I've never done the research. But because of the control that the Orthodox have, it's absolutely become an issue, and these women are seen as inciting riots, essentially.
Yeah, so
and that's
against that kind of a law, anyway.
That's what seems to be causing the arrests. So it's, it's a heartbreaking situation, as far as I see it. Yeah.
I'm just picking up on what Brian said. So, am I understanding correctly that we, in essence, we have a form of Sanhedrin that is guiding the government of Israel? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. I don't know if I would call it quite that. But the interests of the ultra-Orthodox are much more at play because the majority of the members of parliament, the members of the Knesset, are going to be individuals representing Orthodox traditions. We saw a rise in the late 70s. We start to see the Likud party, Benjamin Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, who is the prime minister of the State of Israel, again. he's never leaving at this rate.
He's in Canada today, by the way.
Yes, he is, in fact. I did read that.
He'll be here in about 20 minutes.
Great.
It was a surprise. I knew you wanted to see him.
I'm thrilled. I've met him, actually.
Right.
But the Likud party, which he represents, came to power in the 1970s, in the late 1970s. It sort of came to power, and it sort of came at a time when the Labour Party, which up until that point had been the dominant party, this was the party that Rabin represented, this is the party that Shimon Peres, who was president of the state, and probably one of the longest-running members of the Knesset, he's one of the few liberals who's still left, in a sense. And if I could sort of use these very gross exaggerations, the Labour Party has always sort of been the liberal, the Likud represents sort of a moderate voice, but now the Likud has turned a bit more to the right. And then, of course, also around that same time, we had the rise of the party of Shas. Shas is an ultra-Orthodox Sephardi party for Jews who, representing Jews who come from the Middle East, from Yemen, from Morocco, from Iran, from Iraq, from those kinds of areas. And those were voices that in the 1950s, for example, these are people who came to Israel thinking they were going to find this brand new life. And much like we hear stories in the States of immigrants who thought they were going to find something and didn't, they were placed in these sort of little neighborhoods, very sort of shanty towns, if you will. They thought they were going to get new apartments and new buildings, and instead they got shacks. And they, you know, you can see this. There's a famous Israeli film called Salah Shabati, which came out probably in the 1960s or 70s. Chaim Topol, who played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, plays the main character. And Salah, it's his family coming from Morocco, I believe they come, or from Yemen. I can't remember which. And it's a fantastic sort of story of this experience. Here they are. They think they're going to get this great experience, and they don't. And with the rise of the Shas party, initially, it wasn't quite as ultra-Orthodox as it is, but the longer that people are living in the state of Israel, there's sort of this ironic experience that these are people who initially don't believe that the Messiah, you know, we should be building a state of Israel until the Messiah comes, but on the other hand, these are the same people who are taking advantage of the state and sort of, you know, living there and not serving the army and doing all these different things. But, you know, it's not really, it shouldn't be. The state shouldn't be yet. But this party, as it grew in strength, it seems there's a lot of a shift toward ultra-Orthodoxy. And Shatz today, I can't recall, at least within the last 15, 20 years, has held the largest number of seats. So therefore, the interests of that ultra-Orthodox party community, which, by the way, is one of the largest, you'll see. In Jerusalem, there's a neighborhood called Mea Shearim, literally 100 gates. They are this, like, little microcosm of primarily Ashkenazi or Eastern European descent Jews, ultra-Orthodox. They're small. Around the country, you're getting the people who come from this from the Sephardi background, from the Middle Eastern and Spanish background. These people are actually much more traditional, without necessarily being Orthodox. But the numbers of ultra-Orthodox now are growing so strong that their interests are most represented. So I don't know that you can say there's a Sanhedrin, but these are the people who are holding the highest offices. So the chief rabbinate of Israel, there's a rabbi by the name of Ovadia Yosef who makes decrees constantly. And there are so many followers, right? That they're not so strong in numbers, but they're strong in voices, and they're voting. Let me tell you, they're voting. These are the people who go out and vote. They get on planes. El Al, Israel's airline, does a sale around election time. You fly to Israel for $400. Let me tell you how many ultra-Orthodox Jews have taken advantage of the ability that they have through what's called the law of return to become citizens of the state. And then they get on a plane once every 2 years or whatever it is, and they go for 4 days and they vote. And so those are the voices that are getting heard. It's a vocal minority. But so I wouldn't say a Sanhedrin. I wouldn't argue that there's necessarily a one unified body, but rather that you're getting people in ultra-Orthodox positions who are in the higher status positions. It's kind of an interesting experience. So we need liberal voices supporting Israel. That's what I'm going to say.
It's kind of interesting that, I mean, as you describe it, I can't help but think of Iran. I know that that makes you grimace.
Yeah,
but,
a little bit.
what you've described is this layered situation where religious authority manifests itself politically, but sometimes it's not direct, but it's there. And we have a few other examples around the world where this actually functions as well. There's differences. I mean, I don't mean to discount those differences
sure,
at all.
Sure.
But it is a curious matter.
What I would say with that is I think that one of the distinctions, again, to hold is that Israel, despite all of what I've just said, despite all these influences, still remains a democratic state. Yeah, I guess technically. I don't know.
Well,
I can't think of Ahmadinejad
as democratic.
Is it? Really? I think of him as the dictator. I don't know.
You could build it in.
You know, this is the thing, is that that Israel, I think, is a little bit further away from being quite in that situation.
Yeah.
you know, you're seeing a lot of the religious have their own decrees. They're getting, they use their rabbis as their ultimate authorities. A fascinating piece I read, very sad, sad article a few months ago appeared in the newspaper about a decree that was, or a warning, I should say, that was being placed out there by these rabbis, for example. And they were saying, women of Israel, beware. There are all these Arab men out there. They're coming to trick you. They're going to tell you that they love you. They're going to tell you, and you know, when they say Arab, they also sometimes mean non-Jews. And it's a heartbreaking scenario. But they're saying to them, you know, and this was coming from the rabbis' wives. This is the other thing that's so sad, is that they're using women as if it's like an empowered sort of thing. They're going to tell you they love you. They're going to tell you all these great stories, and they're going to want to marry you. And you're going to get married to them. And then you're going to find yourself in abusive situations. It's a heartbreaking, racist, xenophobic, awful thing to say. And it's up to us to sort of, again, right? Because if you look at the state of Israel, we were talking about this also on the way down, it's become much more multicultural in the sense that you now have people where once it was primarily Jews of Eastern European descent and some Moroccans and some Yemenite Jews. Now you're getting people who are not Jewish at all. You're getting people from Europe. You're getting people from Africa. There's a huge number of people now from not just Ethiopia, because as many of you may know, Israel staged a rescue of Ethiopian Jews through Operation Solomon in the 1980s and 90s, so that, in fact, I think 99.9% of all Ethiopian Jews are living in Israel now, if not, or at least started off in Israel, have been out of Ethiopia. But now you're getting people from Kenya and Zimbabwe and wherever else. And you're getting people from a lot of foreign workers from, you know, Asia and from wherever else. So now it's not so much monochromatic in a way, right? You're getting a lot more people. And with that, there seems to be an increased xenophobia. And that's something that we were talking about as well. And, you know, it's heartbreaking to me that we see that. But what I will say is that, yes, it's multi-layered. The religious right, as I say, I think for whatever reason, the rabbinate seems to hold this really powerful seat. And, you know, I think also if you look at the Supreme Court of Israel, which is a civil body, some of the voices there falling influence to that, or falling victim to that influence.
I'd be interested in maybe turning a little bit away from the political part vis-a-vis Israel to having you reflect on one of the themes that you did such a lovely job on in terms of your own journey,
mm-hmm.
and I'd be interested in how you're working with that within the Reform community in Edmonton. You talked about your sojourn in the Orthodox
yes.
community and how initially you resisted even going.
Oh, yeah.
And then when you went, you fell in love with
mm-hmm.
it. You fell in love with both the fact that you could live God's time instead of the banker's time.
Absolutely.
The way in which Sabbath works, mm-hmm. which is such a wonderful, wonderful thing. You talked about the disciplines that were there and those suddenly got some traction from you. But then also the ideological issues and theological mm-hmm. issues which began to push back, which led you back. But while you were there, this issue of community
mm-hmm.
was something that you discovered in a new and fruitful way. In your current work in giving shape and form to the community in Edmonton, can you speak a little bit about this issue of the gift of community?
Absolutely.
And then how that was within the Orthodox context. In a sense, they built a fence around the community with the disciplines. It's a nice phrase, huh? You build a fence around the Torah, around the living Torah.
Absolutely.
And the disciplines do that. The disciplines can mm-hmm. do that. Within the Reformed community, how does that sit? How does the community issue sit? And how is that nurture? What do you make of it at this point?
Okay. So I guess I would address this. I'm going to start sort of from the inside out, rather. One of the things that I think you're alluding to, maybe you're not, maybe it's in my head, maybe I'm going to allude to it, or maybe I'll just say it. I think that over the course of time, there is a tendency, as you did mention, because of the nature of orthodoxy for all faiths, to be a bit more insular, because you are reading things very literally, and there isn't room for an outside sort of connection, right? There is a right, there is a wrong, and if you're outside the boundary of what is correct or what is seen as appropriate, then it just doesn't fit into your space. Conversely, I also think that for many years, part of my own experience, in addition to, of course, very much just being young. I think all of us, and I say ironically only because I get teased a lot that that I'm so young. You know, I keep asking people, if I'm 34 now and I'm still young, when do I get older? When am I finally older? But, you know, I think that certainly I've had enough life experience to say that I can look back on something that happened 15 years ago now and say, yeah, that was, I was young and frankly, kind of dumb. You know, I think that there is a tendency, especially within these two communities, the Reform and the Orthodox, to be sort of defensive, and particularly in the Reform community, because for many years, the Reform community has, you know, we are a breakoff of traditional Judaism. The Reform movement started, if it's okay if I just step into this for a second. Basically, the Reform movement started in Germany about 200 years ago in the context of the Enlightenment. It came about as the result of actually Napoleon in France being the first, and then shortly thereafter other communities, including Germany and others in Europe, giving emancipation to the Jews. For many years, Jews lived in a consistory system. They were not full citizens of the countries in which they lived, and therefore they were only bound by Jewish law. Their lives were governed by it. When Napoleon and then furthermore other countries offered them the opportunity to become full citizens of those countries, number one, they don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. They're interested in becoming full citizens. They want to be a part of the societies in which they live. And number two, aside from fear of being accused of treason, which could happen if they were to hold Jewish law above civil law, they also are looking to show we're just as capable as anyone else. We're just like you. So the Reform movement comes about as the result of that context, number one, or within that context. Number two, it's also surrounded by an idea as I said, the Enlightenment and the idea of reason and rationale being very important. It comes from the perspective of biblical criticism, which means that we don't necessarily understand the Torah to be the literal word of God, but rather a human document. What's important for us is the fact that it exists and what this story means for us, but when it's not the word of God, then suddenly it doesn't have that same binding power that it does when we say, this is the word of God from God's words to Moses at Sinai, and we do not take away or we do not add to it. When you say it's a human document, that changes things significantly. So as Reformed Jews, we have for many years, over the course of time, in an attempt to fit into the society around us, in an attempt to sort of find ourselves and find our way, David, you mentioned earlier the idea that we have a return to tradition. There was a period of time between about 1890 and 1930, especially in the United States, where the movement has taken hold most strongly, where what defined us was really a commitment to universalism and not to the particularism. People were trying to fit into this new society. There was also a real sense of not being connected to ritual. Ritual sort of fell by the wayside. And we've had to sort of return to it. And as a result, I think that the Reform movement has sort of gained a little bit of an inferiority complex. Because even though people who can tell you, I'm so proud of what I do, and they say, this is my choice, this is what I choose, the number one contributor to Chabad, if people are familiar with Chabad, the Lubavitch movement, are people familiar?
Yeah.
Number one contributor to Chabad are liberal Jews.
Yeah.
Probably Reform Jews.
Yeah.
Because there's an authenticity to what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? They're wearing the costumes, if you'll excuse the
By contributors, you mean?
Financial contributors.
Financial contributors.
Financial contributors.
As well as probably their children converting.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
Not necessarily. There are many who choose that, but I'm talking financial.
Yeah.
Financially, Chabad is supported by liberal Jews. And it's ironic, because they don't represent necessarily what we do ideologically or theologically. But in fact, look at what they do. They dress in these clothes that represent, you know, Fiddler on the Roof kind of style clothing, right? These are the things that are an ideal in a sense. They look authentic, they sound authentic because they speak Yiddish, and they speak with an authority that is very decisive. When I say to you, we don't have one theology or one ideology, and when you become your own ultimate authority, which is ultimately the way in which Reform Judaism understands itself, it places a certain modicum of responsibility on you. And sometimes people don't know how to handle that. So I would argue that one of the things is that in sort of growing up spiritually, I think that the best gift that I could give is to show people that there's not a need to be defensive, but rather you need to connect for yourself with what it is that you understand, and you need to feel comfortable in saying what I do is authentic, what I do is valid. In working with the conversion candidates, for example, it's one of the things I'll tell them. You need to understand that what I do isn't necessarily viewed as valid by the Orthodox. You need to be comfortable with the fact that what I'm doing is valid for you and valid in your eyes, because if it's not going to be valid for you, then you're going to keep questioning, and it's not worth going through an entire process unless you feel comfortable within it. I look toward Edmonton as Jewish communities go, although it's much larger than the one here. It's a small Jewish community. We're somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 Jews. I strongly believe in the idea that we should all be on the same page. I've worked very closely with Rabbi David Kunin of the Conservative Congregation. We do lots of things together. He and I both sit, he is actually president of the Edmonton Interfaith Center currently. It's a role that he's held for the last 2 years, and I know that he's very passionate about the work that he does with people of other faiths. But in addition, I think we both look toward our Orthodox colleagues, and I'd like to show respect to them. First and foremost, I would argue that both the Chabad rabbi and the Orthodox rabbi in Edmonton, as well as a recent arrival, we've got a new principal and head of school for what's called the Menorah Academy. It is associated with Chabad, but it is not their school per se. And all of them, we are constantly working together now. We try very much to hold community events. So last year we tried very hard to, we're about to celebrate the Festival of Purim, which I think is often known as the Feast of Esther outside of the Jewish community. And we tried very hard to create a community event. We found that to be unfortunately not fully realized last year, because there became a little bit of an issue, in fact, with women's roles in the spiel, in the play that we would do, where we suggested singing.
Because, of course, in the feast itself and in the text, the woman had such a minor role.
But see, Jewish law comes into play, and the idea of a woman, for example, my reading from the Megillah, my chanting, I should say, from the Megillah, from the scroll, becomes problematic for an Orthodox Jew as a male. We almost worked around it. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. But in fact, I think ultimately, if you ask any of us in the city, I think all of us have the highest regard for one another. One of my roles, as I see it, is to teach people in the Reform community, and I would say probably most Reform Jews who are born Reform Jews, I find it's less of an issue with someone who chooses Reform Judaism. Usually when you make a conscious choice with Reform Judaism, as a young adult or as an adult, it's something that you're much more connected to on a theological and ideological and spiritual level. When you grow up as a Jew, and a liberal Jew, I think my goal is to sort of say to people, look, there's what to be learned here. It's important that we know what this tradition is. It's also important that you know why you choose or don't choose to follow it. And ultimately, in Reform Judaism, I could be very observant. I can absolutely choose to be observant if I want, Reform-wise. Doesn't have to be, right? I'm my own ultimate authority. I make choices. but I make those choices through knowledge. And I think that my goal is to try and say to people, look, there is value in each one of these authentic traditions. Yes, we are a break off of what was, but we are an authentic tradition. And I hope that you can, again, coming back to that idea of making your own choices, being conscious of your own stance theologically and ideologically, and being able to articulate what it is that you believe, and knowing that there is what to be learned from other traditions as well.
Yeah. I mean, I know that Chabad has kind of a very strong sense of maybe proselytizing or recruiting. You know, when I'm thinking about the different branches of Judaism, we spoke, maybe it was last week or the week before,
I think it was last week.
And you discussed this idea that from the Jewish perspective, Messiah can't come until everyone's Torah observant, I think is the way you phrase it.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of influence within the Jewish community to try to bring everybody more towards orthodoxy for that kind of a fulfillment to happen? Do you feel those pressures within the community, or is that not really there at all?
Not in the
Edmonton. We're all really
Jewish
interested
community.
In when the Messiah is coming. Cameras. This is a big issue locally. So
I will.
If you
I
got
will
any
actually,
insight.
Well, I'll share with you what where the Reform movement stands. This is one other thing that sort of places us a bit outside the box. And unlike traditional Judaism, which would say exactly that when the Messiah comes, it will be a time of utopia. And we're talking about a time with no war, no hunger, you know, none of these bad things are happening. And the way in which we bring that about is through the fulfillment of mitzvot, of commandments. And I think, as I said, I think the teaching I was sharing with you says something along the lines of, when all Jews in the world keep the Sabbath, according to Jewish law, two Sabbaths in a row, then the Messiah will come. First of all, I say good luck. Second of all, additionally, of course, associated with the Messiah coming is then the building of the third temple in Jerusalem. We will return to sacrifice as part of this utopia. And as many of you may have heard, this is where I'm only going to touch on this. I don't actually know that we have the time to get into the big discussion, but this is where resurrection comes in of the dead Jewishly, because as you may or may not know, one of the elements traditionally is said that when the Messiah comes, all the dead will be resurrected in order to serve in the temple. Reform Judaism says, look, we don't believe in a person. We believe in the age. We believe in this utopia. But the way in which we understand ourselves is partners with God. And through acts of what's called tikkun olam, or repair of the world, we look to make a difference in creating that reality. So if we're partners with God, we have to do our part. You see hunger in the world, it's your job to make sure that people are not hungry. If I see war, it's my job to go out there and to make peace. And so as a result, Messiah does not play at all into my understanding.
As an era, but as an era, the messianic
sure.
period,
and absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's an important part of what we strive for, but we understand it again as being something that we help bring about through those acts. And I have to apologize. I've already sort of lost the original question in there. You asked about Chabad and...
Is there a movement to reunite Judaism so that these fulfillments can take place?
So the answer is, overall, I would say sure, in the world. You go down the street... Again, you've been in Jerusalem, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody else been to Jerusalem? When you go to Jerusalem, you're going to see people, and anywhere along Israel, but particularly in Jerusalem, you're going to see these guys, these yeshiva bachers, okay? And they're going to be standing at folding tables, much the size of that. And they're going to have the tefillin, the phylacteries, and they're going to have prayer books. And what they're basically going to do is they're going to pull the men, okay? All of you who are over 13, beware. You are subject to this. Because what they do is they don't ask questions. They just pull you aside. Have you laid tefillin today? Come on. Come help us.
Put on tefillin.
They don't ask you if you're Jewish or not. They just assume. There is that happening. It happens in Israel. In Edmonton, not so much. At the end of the day, while my Orthodox colleagues have communities that are a bit larger, I don't think that there is proselytization going on. Again, I think that we are, as a community, primarily committed to the fact that we are a community. It's something that I actually really do believe is happening there, is that we try to keep our community as pluralistic as possible, so that if you go into our Edmonton Jewish Federation, the executive director of our federation, for example, is a member of the conservative synagogue, as is the current president. while there are things happening, I don't feel that anybody is coming and saying, you know, when they invite me to come to their Purim or Hanukkah celebrations, there's nobody coming to me and saying, you should do these things or you should come and be part of our community. It's just to celebrate together. I don't feel that pressure in Edmonton. I think it does exist outside of Edmonton, absolutely, but primarily in Jerusalem. Yeah.
While we're on the topic of the Messiah, one of the other speakers in this series said that the greatest contributor to Zionism are right-wing American conservative Christians,
mm-hmm.
because they're looking
yep.
for Armageddon first before
yep.
the Messiah comes. Could you comment on that?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you why I can comment on it is because, in fact, it's something that we have seen in Edmonton as recently as this year. There's an organization in the States called Christians United for Israel. We, as a Jewish community this year, headed by our Orthodox rabbi is actually working currently on I can't remember if it's a doctoral dissertation or a master's thesis on Christian Zionism. So he's got a great number of connections. And the answer is that the more traditional Jews tend to connect very much and look to support Israel almost under any circumstance, in a sense. As a result, there was an event in Edmonton this year that was a sort of pro-Israel rally, if you will, held by the Jewish community jointly with the Christians United for Israel. My community and I spoke about it at great length, and one of the things that troubled us was that the founder, Reverend Hagee, who's the founder of the Christians United for Israel organization, shares a different value system than what we have. So he has written extensively. I've seen excerpts of what he's written. I can't say I'm an expert on the subject, but I read some of what he had to say. And amongst other things, we noted that there were teachings that were, anti-gay or anti-this or anti-that. And he didn't stand for us as a whole for some of the values. So while we absolutely support Israel in our community, we felt that this particular venue was not right for us. So my community actually opted not to participate in this pro-Israel rally, but rather to do other pro-Israel things, because we felt that this individual, right, this organization, didn't represent where we stood as Reform Jews on other subjects.
Did the conservatives participate?
I believe he did attend, because there's so I would say that, yeah. The Jewish community is sort of split.
It's a community thing.
The Jewish community, not in Edmonton, but as a whole, is split, in a sense. And on the one hand, some people say, look, we need all the support we can get for Israel, and we'll take it from wherever it comes. Some people will say, and I think rightly so, it's important to hear what everybody has to say. I think it's important for me to read what Reverend Hagee has to say, to hear what the organization has to say. I can disagree with what they say, and we can still be in the same room. I think that's an important thing. I think that ultimately we can't, squash someone's freedom of speech in any way, shape, or form. I also think we have the right to disagree, and I think that that's where the other sort of camp lies, and that's to say that as many in my own congregation felt, this as the founder of the movement, his feelings in many other areas so came into contrast or into contradiction with where we stand on issues. And so much of where we stand is based on an importance of human rights and other things that we felt there were other ways to support Israel and felt that this wasn't the way in which to do it. So I think that you'll find in the Jewish world sort of a split, and many will tell you it's great to have that kind of support. Others will say, we question their motives. We question this whole Armageddon thing, and this is, this isn't right. And then there will be those who say, I'll listen to what he has to say, but I'm not sure that I'm going to take it. So I think it's kind of, there is no one consensus on it. But.
What do you think, Peter? Any?
No, I just sort of seeking some clarification. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I can give much more than that, but I can speak to the fact, like I say, I think you will find that there is, it's either, most people are either going to question that sort of motive and that type of support, and if it's not for the same reasons that we support Israel, right, because ultimately we're looking toward in a sense, if I understand correctly, and I apologize because I don't mean to, it's quite plausible I misunderstand, but my sense was with the Armageddon teaching that ultimately we're talking about something that is going to replace the modern state of Israel. It's not going to be what we have today. And so in that sense, some people are going to say, no, this is absolutely not supportive of Israel in that sense. And there are others who are going to say, you know, it doesn't matter. It's absolutely, you know, we want all the support we can get because right now we don't, obviously, if there are not enough Jews standing up for Israel, then we need to.
You need to have your friends wherever you can find them.
Exactly.
John?
Sometimes,
and we'll have to bring this to an end, at least the formal part, with you.
I sometimes got the impression through Peggy and others, he's not the only one, that Israel is really, when you look at it, is a pawn in their much larger goal of bringing the Messiah back.
Yeah. I mean,
is that accurate?
I don't know if I could say yes or no. I can tell you that it's certainly a perception that I can share to a degree, but you know, ultimately, again, because we have different understandings of what Israel is, right? I'm looking toward a democratic modern state, which is a Jewish homeland. You know, it's not the same thing that they're looking toward. So, in that sense, sure, I would agree with you, but that's my personal opinion. It's not based on anything else. So,
and one could, of course, flip it around too. I mean, Norton Medvinsky flipped it around and said that they were a pawn in terms of Israeli politics.
Which is probably also true. Yeah. You know, it's complex and complicated and, you know.
The last question I had in my mind. You were able to attend a Reform school in the States.
Yes.
Where is the closest Reform school in Canada?
There is none, and the reason I say this is because, in fact, there are no rabbinic seminaries in Canada. One of the reasons that it's actually very easy for me to come into Canada, I'm here on a visitor record, which has a unique clergy allowance. I'm not sure how many seminaries are in Canada altogether, in fact, beyond, I can't speak for...
38.
Okay. Not very many. As a rabbi, it's very easy for a congregation here to show that they have a need for me to come in because there aren't rabbis being trained in Canada. So there are four campuses of the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, one in Jerusalem, one in Cincinnati, which is where I attended, Cincinnati being the original campus founded in 1875, and one in New York and one in Los Angeles. And they are ordaining approximately, in my time, a few years ago, we were a class of approximately 60 or so. You know, there could be as few as 30. There could be as many as, you know, it just depends on the year and then how many people are enrolled. But, they're the closest Reform to here, Los Angeles.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And,
yeah, it's been a pleasure, and I'm glad for the opportunity, and thanks so much for a warm welcome and wonderful discussion.
Good to have you.
Very thoughtful question.